Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of Conversations at the World Affairs Council. In this broadcast, we'll hear about last December's climate negotiations in Paris, including the outsized role that the Marshall Islands had to play. We'll hear from former British diplomat Karen Ross. He's executive director of Independent Diplomat, and he'll be in conversation with Amy Barnes of Allotrope Partners. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Amy Barnes.
So, Karen, I wanted to start off by sort of putting in context for the audience the environment that existed going into the Paris climate talks. So It was actually almost 6 months ago when leaders from around the world were descending on Paris to kick off negotiations on a global agreement on climate change, and this built on months and years of negotiations and preparation. At the same time, there was a very somber mood in Paris following the Paris attacks that had happened just a month prior. So can you sort of contextualize for the audience what the atmosphere was like in Paris in the lead up to the talks?
Well, I think two words would sum it up, which is high stakes. The world had had no agreement about what to do about climate change up until Paris took place. And the goal of the Paris conference and the UN climate negotiations that had been going on for several years was to get a treaty or agreement that every country in the world could commit to. And extraordinarily, though the problem of climate change has been with us now for some time, there is no global agreement about what to do about it. Early agreements had covered only a proportion of countries. And earlier attempts to get a global agreement, of course, had failed, in particular, most famously in 2009 at the Copenhagen Climate Summit. So a lot had been attempted, and Paris was an attempt to do it again. And I think it wasn't at all clear that it was going to succeed. And the fact that a global treaty emerged from Paris is in itself pretty extraordinary. And the fact that it contains some pretty strong elements is even more extraordinary. So something quite remarkable in the world of diplomacy took place in Paris.
Can you talk a little bit about maybe some of those elements and what the key considerations were, the key questions under negotiation sort of going into Paris?
Sure. Well, climate negotiations, as you can imagine, given the nature of the problem, are formidably complicated. I mean, there's a whole host of different issues. And of course, 193 UN member states have a whole host of different concerns and priorities. But I guess the two biggest issues are carbon mitigation. How do you stop or slow carbon emissions in a way that's meaningfully going to stop global warming? And the other issue is who pays? Loss and damage mitigation is a number of different technical terms for it, but who pays for both the effects of climate change, but also the work to convert energy systems to lower carbon energy? And these were the two issues which had, in a sense, become almost on either side of a seesaw and had become the main contested issues that the developed world, if you like, earlier had wanted carbon reduction. The less developed world, if I can term it like that, these terms increasingly don't really mean anything, but they wanted somebody to pay. And they felt that the developed world should pay for the damage that they had largely caused through their own carbon emissions. And that was the essential schism that had bedeviled the climate negotiations and the climate diplomacy for a long time, and was the fundamental reason why Copenhagen failed. There were lots of reasons why Copenhagen failed, but that was the fundamental reason. And by the time we got to Paris, that schism had to an extent been already overcome before Paris even took place. And that was the work of your president, Barack Obama, who should take the credit really for doing that, in particular for forging an agreement which didn't get an awful lot of attention at the time. But his agreement with China, the US-China agreement about 6 months before Paris, was the fundamental thing. When that went through, I think we felt, well, we've got a good chance of getting a global treaty, because that essentially overcame that basic problem, because the Chinese and the Americans basically said we're responsible for both. In a sense, it was about both governments really coming to terms with climate change and deciding that above all they needed an agreement, and that these differences should not prevent that.
I want to maybe take a step back and just contextualize for the audience the sort of magnitude of the challenge. And I think that a helpful way of framing that is talking about the plight that is currently facing the Marshall Islands, the country that Independent Diplomat was representing. So can you just sort of explain to people why the Marshall Islands was so passionate about seeking a not just an outcome, but a really ambitious outcome in Paris.
Sure.
And furthermore, why this led to them sort of playing such a key role in the diplomacy around
that.
Sure.
Well, the Marshall Islands is where the rubber hits the road, basically. They are already suffering very severe effects of climate change, a double whammy of frequent droughts, much more frequent droughts, water shortages, but also increasing flooding from so-called king tides, which are flooding. Even the president's garden is getting flooded. And believe me, if your president's garden was getting flooded, climate change would be a number one issue every day. Not that this president has not taken it seriously, I hasten to add. He's been very serious about it. But it's real there. And it is incredibly moving being with Marshallese and Marshallese political leaders when they talk about it, because it's about their lives, it's about their homes right now. The Marshall's foreign minister, when there was a flood during the negotiations, an earlier meeting, a large ship was beached just outside his home. You know, there was a kind of real physicality of the threat. And this led the Marshalls some time ago to decide that climate change was their number one priority. It's existential for them. If sea level rise continues, they will no longer be able to inhabit those islands. Mm-hmm. They will become climate refugees. They don't like talking about it much, but that is a reality for them. So they're talking about their country actually being destroyed. And it's ironic for them, or perhaps, you know, some other parallel, I don't know, that the Marshalls is also the country that saw 70, I think, nuclear tests over different islands in the atolls. So in a sense, they kind of really experienced the existential threats to humanity already. Mm. Tony de Broome, the foreign minister, had witnessed some of these tests. And non-proliferation, getting rid of nuclear weapons, had been a big priority for him in the past. It still is. But climate change is now the real threat and actually could destroy the Marshalls. So they decided as a government to make it a priority. Several years ago, they began the very, very diligent, meticulous, hard work of beginning to make an impact in climate diplomacy and ended up in Paris. That work culminated in them making this tiny little island, 50,000 people, making an extraordinary diplomatic impact in this highly complex, heavyweight diplomatic negotiations, because they ended up leading a coalition of 30 foreign ministers who represented, in fact, 100 different countries, the so-called High Ambition Coalition that created the political space for what are called the ambition elements of the Paris Treaty. The things that really mattered in the Paris Treaty were, to a large degree, created by the political momentum created by the High Ambition Coalition, which was led by the Marshall Islands.
And can you just talk maybe a little bit more about sort of the inside perspective of helping to build a coalition like that? I think there was a Rolling Stone article that came out after Paris that did a nice job of sort of telling the narrative of how the coalition came together.
Sure.
But it's, you know, certainly part sort of the science and part sort of the art of diplomacy.
Sure.
And I think really a remarkable group that to a large extent can be credited with a successful outcome in Paris alongside the French diplomats who also did a tremendous job.
Totally.
Talk a little bit about, you know, as a diplomat, what it's like seeing something like that to fruition.
The thing about climate diplomacy is it's never been done before. So everybody's doing it for the first time, which is in a way is great because there isn't a route map of how we're going to do it. Like non-proliferation talks or even talks about the war in Syria, there are places we know we're going to do this. There are forums, there's a timetable, we know how it's done. Climate diplomacy in Paris was never done before, which was great because it meant there was a blank sheet of paper. The Marshalls took many years, and I think this is one of the lessons of what they achieved, was that it takes many years to build up the authority and the relationships and the networks and the coalitions to come to Paris and make this kind of impact. And they did it through a couple of ways. Number one was really being dedicated themselves as individuals. Their foreign minister was an immensely charismatic, serious chap who became very respected in the negotiations personally, because diplomacy is still about people. It's not just about your country. Actually, individual diplomats, even of tiny countries or even very junior diplomats, can have an influence far beyond their own importance as a country simply through their own skills and authority. And of course, the Marshalls had an immense moral authority. Everybody knew that the Marshalls were under this extraordinary existential threat. So people paid attention to them for that reason. And they took that moral authority and converted it through very dedicated effort into political authority. And that dedicated effort was showing up to meetings. It was building little private groups of countries, such as the thing called the Cartagena Dialogue, becoming an authoritative source of advice to even big countries like the United States. The United States began to see the Marshalls as a serious interlocutor, not least because the Marshalls brought with them a lot of other countries in the Alliance of Small Island States, because in the UN, weird place that it is, actually, the Marshalls has the same voting power as the US and lots of other little island states. So the island states are actually a formidable diplomatic grouping in their own right. But they also did things which were imaginative and new. They made declarations about how the world needed to address climate change. Again, things that had not been done before, a normative declaration called the Majuro Declaration, which Majuro is the capital of the Marshalls, which said we need more action, and invited countries to come and sign this declaration. And extraordinarily, countries like the US, the EU, and Japan ended up signing that declaration. So over a period of years, they kind of built up their authority until in Paris, they had this group of countries around them. It was still secret, remarkably. They'd had secret meetings with this group all the way up until Paris. And then that group broke cover in Paris, and it broke up the traditional negotiating blocks of the UN, such as the G77, the EU, because the coalition that the Marshalls had formed include countries from all of these different groups, and kind of exploded the normal negotiating behavior of traditional UN negotiations.
And that, I think, in and of itself is a tremendous achievement. I don't know, folks in the audience have worked in the world of the UN, but I also worked in the climate negotiations for a number of years, and getting UN countries to think beyond sort of the standard negotiating blocks is incredibly difficult. So I think that's a huge testament to the work that you were able to do.
Well, I think it's also because of the extraordinary nature of climate change. I've been really impressed by the quality of climate diplomats, people like Cristina Figueres, who was the UN main official on climate, an extraordinary, charismatic, passionate woman. A lot of the ministers who work on climate are very passionate about it. I've been in meetings where people get diplomacy people often get surprisingly worked up, given that it's supposed to be this kind of calm discourse of people listening politely to each other. People get very cross and very worked up. And in climate, though, we're lucky enough to have a lot of people who are very passionate about it, but also good at diplomacy. The US diplomats who worked on it were extraordinarily impressive. And above all, in Paris, the French were amazing. And they should take a lot of the credit for what happened in France. And I was thinking rather rudely about the comparison between Copenhagen and France, and it's partly the comparison between Danish diplomats and French diplomats. Danish diplomats are great, fantastic, professional, but French diplomats have this certain, self-belief. France is a great country, and it gives you a confidence in negotiating a piece of paper with 193 countries, and gave Laurent Fabius the confidence at the end of the negotiation to take a piece of paper that had barely been agreed, that was kind of a fragile thing, could have unraveled almost 100 different directions, and said, anybody disagree with this piece of paper? No? Good. Bang. It's done. We've got a global treaty. Takes a Frenchman to do that.
Well, so I wanted to actually focus in on the last hours of the talks, because I think it's sort of a perfect example of how delicate and fragile these agreements are. Mm. And, again, sort of the contrast to Copenhagen, where you had sort of the night before an agreement that very much could have on the next day been signed. And because of some missteps by the Danes, I think, lack of transparency, which is something you talked about in some of your books, but other missteps in terms of shepherding the process through along the way, I think, it all fell apart.
Yeah.
And we saw in Paris, sort of in the last couple of hours, this issue with the text, and this is a very sort of UN-ish problem, but this question of shall versus should in one paragraph.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if maybe you could sort of elaborate for people what the challenge is and why in diplomacy the word craft with something as small as that can make the difference between a successful Paris Agreement or everybody going home.
Sure. Well, one word can make an enormous difference in a negotiation, as the Palestinians would tell you, but that's another story, the difference between occupied territories and the occupied territories. Anyway, but this was about one word, shall and should. And this all goes back to the US Senate, which unfortunately is populated by a majority of people who do not believe that the US should sign up to a global treaty. And of course, the US delegation was very open about this and said, we can't have a treaty that requires us to ratify in the Senate. So it can't be called a legally binding treaty. Even though it kind of is a legally binding treaty, it can't be called that. And that word, shall and should, was where that problem arose, that a draft appeared very late in the day that said the countries who are party to the agreement shall reduce carbon by the amount that they've committed to rather than should. And should have been the word that everybody, including the US, had agreed. And suddenly the American negotiators saw this word, shall. My goodness, that's a bad word, because that means if that goes through, we're going to have to take it to the Senate to be ratified, which is and we can't do that. That's going to kill the treaty. So they needed should. And they couldn't understand, and it's still a mystery to this day, why should appeared in the text rather than, sorry, why shall appeared in the text rather than should. And I don't think anybody's got to the bottom of why the draft was changed. Perhaps it was somebody being mischievous, perhaps somebody trying to disrupt the negotiations, and there were people who didn't want that treaty to succeed. But fortunately, the Americans held their nerve, got it fixed. The French ran round fixing everybody's text and banged it through. And so now it says countries should meet their carbon commitments rather than shall. And it means it doesn't have to be ratified by the Senate.
Which is an important thing.
It is.
So I wanted to talk, we talked a little bit about some of the main outcomes, the sort of finance and mitigation trade-offs. And so, you know, I think there have been a lot of critiques of the Paris Agreement. There have been a lot of, you know, positive things said about it. But at the end of the day, when you look at the commitments that are included amongst the intended nationally determined contributions, which are the sort of individual country commitments to reduce emissions, those add up to sort of at best a 2.7C scenario, which is well above the 1.5C scenario that the agreement aspirationally commits to. What's sort of your sense about, you know, how we should feel about this? Is this an agreement that we should feel really positive about? Do you see it as a success, or do you see it as a failure because it didn't sort of meet the goals that we set aspirationally?
Well, it never was going to be enough. It never was going to be a perfect treaty because it was never going to be legally binding. It was never going to have a mechanism to police countries to make sure they kept to their commitments. It was the best available agreement, which is still a good thing because it now gives us the first ever global agreement to deal with climate change. And one of the things the Marshalls succeeded in getting into the treaty was what we called the ratchet, which means that every 5 years, countries have to come back to the table with better carbon reduction commitments than the ones they made in Paris. When we started, it was going to be a 15-year cycle. We made it a 5, which is one of the great things that the Marshalls achieved. So it's a vehicle. I think the way to look at it is to see it as a framework, a vehicle for the world addressing climate change. But it would be a great mistake to think that it's enough, because it's not. As you say, the aggregation of all the national commitments to reduce carbon don't do anything like enough in terms of the science that we're seeing now to keep us to the aspiration of temperature rise of between 1.5 and 2 degrees centigrade, which is what Paris says should be the maximum. We're nowhere near that in terms of the commitments that have been made under Paris. So what the Marshalls are doing now is taking that coalition that they formed in the run-up to Paris, the High Ambition Coalition, these 30-odd countries, and hopefully using that as a vehicle to force the countries that signed up to Paris to do better within the Paris framework. I mean, there probably will never be in our lifetimes another kind of big global treaty about climate. It will be Paris plus. Paris will be the framework from now on. And in that sense, it's a good framework, but it's not enough.
Can you talk a little bit about, you've started, I think, here, but a little bit about the next steps, some of which after Paris have already happened. So the opening of the signatories, for signatories to the agreement took place on Earth Day on April 22nd.
Yeah.
So where are we now on the pathway towards implementation, towards ratification?
Sure. Well, Paris goes into force when 55 countries that represent 55% of global emissions have ratified it. And it's looking much against expectations that that might be achieved this year. And there is, of course, an ulterior reason for that, which is a certain things happens early next year, which is there is a new U.S. administration. And the Obama administration is working very, very hard behind the scenes to get early ratification. But, of course, that's in everybody's interest, because the sooner Paris goes into force, the better. So the marshals with the High Ambition Coalition are pushing for that very hard. But then, to be honest, the really difficult work begins. And, you know, God knows, you in California know this as well as anybody. The big challenge is energy conversion, converting our world economy to carbon neutrality. Paris says we need sources of carbon to equal sinks of carbon by 2050, so-called carbon neutrality. And we are so far from doing that. And Paris is an aspiration, it's a declaration of intent. What it is not is the incredibly hard work of transforming national economies to carbon neutral technologies.
I want to switch gears a little bit and ask you a somewhat personal question. It's also related to your work at Independent Diplomat. Can you talk a little bit about what it's like as an independent diplomat who's not somebody sort of from the country that you're representing? What's the experience like of being in these processes and supporting those countries? And I ask this question as somebody who's done similar work for the United Arab Emirates and for the UK. I mean, my sense has been in that experience that sometimes it's a little bit difficult to break through because, A, the world of UN diplomacy is very sort of insular, but also there's an expectation that you're working with diplomats that are sort of representatives from that country.
Sure. Well, when I was a British diplomat, I very much believed that the only people I took seriously were the diplomats from other countries, Russians, Americans, French, Chinese. I didn't take NGOs very seriously. I was very dismissive, very arrogant about them. And also, kind of, you know, being a British diplomat was a very particular kind of thing where you go around the world kind of telling people what to do. You didn't do an awful lot of listening. And your colleagues and your tribe, if you were other Brits, which was, of course, a very familiar tribe to me. I'm not disloyal to them, but I kind of know them. And the work I do now brings an extraordinary privilege of actually being in somebody else's tribe, because we're not mediating, we're not attempting to fix agreements, we're not even attempting to fix climate change. What we're attempting to do is to help the marshals get what they want, to help the Sahrawis get what they want, what the Syrian opposition get what they want. So you become their co-conspirator, you become their ally, you're in the trenches with them. And to be in the trenches with people fighting the battles of their lives is the most extraordinarily moving and powerful experience, one that I never expected when I started. I thought it was just this technocratic business that we'd be kind of, you go through that door at the UN, then, you know, there's this resolution that you need to read. But in fact, what it is, the experience of it personally has been much more powerful and emotional. Of you know, good and bad, because it is not nice being a refugee in a refugee camp in the Sahara Desert for 40 years, as the Sahrawi have been. But, you know, when my children were born, they were the only children in Britain, in London at least, who got sent a bouquet of flowers by a Guevarist national liberation movement from the Sahara Desert. And that meant something to me.
Absolutely. What do you think sort of the experience of working for Independent Diplomat and the work that you're doing sort of says about the broader future of diplomacy? And if I may ask an incredibly expansive question, how do you think we can sort of take the lessons from the Paris outcomes and apply that to broader UN diplomacy?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think what's happening in climate is indicative of what's happening in diplomacy in general, except in some spheres, which is it's breaking up. It's becoming a much more open thing. NGOs were much more accepted in the climate process than in a traditional government-to-government negotiation. The other thing that has happened is I think media and public pressure has become much more important than it was. And that's not only social media. It's also somehow the public realm and, you know, the sort of mood music, the temperature of the air is mattering much more to political leaders than it necessarily used to. It used to be a very formal, secret process of diplomats talking to diplomats, where unless you talk to those diplomats, you had no influence on the process. And now you can actually start a movement through Twitter which can affect directly a diplomatic process. We started a thing, it's a rather esoteric thing, but we got sanctions on aviation fuel against Syria agreed in the EU solely through Twitter. And I used to be like, oh, for God's sake, social media, don't be ridiculous, you know. Diplomacy is about, you know, people, men sitting in rooms making hard-headed agreements with each other. But actually, it's now been broken up. I think that's both a good and a bad thing. I think it's become much more complicated to be a diplomat. I think global problems are much harder to get agreement about that is meaningful. Yeah. You could argue the climate agreement is not actually meaningful. What are agreements about national security globally today? Are they really meaningful? What do they really mean? If governments share intelligence, is that going to help us stop terrorism? Will that be anything like enough? Probably not. I mean, I think it's an enormously complicated phenomenon that's breaking out now, where the good thing for groups like us is that innovation, creativity, determination really pay in a way that didn't used to be the case, where little powerless countries like the Marshalls can make a big impact in a way that they, I think 20 years ago, you could not have done this.
Sure. I was interested in reviewing some of what you've written, both in Independent Diplomat and in just some of your writings, about some of the critiques that you levy against the sort of general process of diplomacy, many of which, having worked in that sphere, I would tend to agree with. And, you know, you talk about the lack of transparency. You had an article that I thought was interesting about the need for independence of the Secretary General, and we've seen recently with the issues with Saudi Arabia essentially censoring the Secretary General in terms of some of the things that have happened in Yemen, that I think there's a pretty good case for that. So could you maybe talk a little bit more about some of the things that you think would be helpful in terms of broader UN reform? Mm-hmm. And my question that I'm personally most interested in, if you have a thought on a pick for the new UN Secretary General to succeed Ban Ki-moon, and whether you think Cristiano Figueres, the former climate head of the climate talks, sure, has a chance.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think as a matter of general principle, whether you're reforming a government, a democracy, or the UN, accountability and transparency need to be promoted. And the UN is desperately untransparent, and officials at the UN are incredibly unaccountable, whether it's for sexual abuse by peacekeepers in the CAR or whatever. But also the states are unaccountable. So states like Russia and Britain make decisions in the UN Security Council for which they're not accountable. And that is not a good thing. It doesn't build legitimacy. It doesn't build effectiveness. That is an obvious route to go in the United Nations. Another obvious route is to improve the Secretariat itself and to have genuinely independent people making good recommendations to the UN Security Council, which remains the world's primary body for peace and security, about how, for instance, to stop war in Syria. That it is less a place where the Russians are allowed to play national argy-bargy with everybody else. It is more a technocratic place where serious people discuss how to stop war. It seems to me that given the history of the last 20 years, Bosnia, Rwanda, now Syria, 250,000 people have been killed by their government in Syria. This is the priority, stopping people being killed, from which a whole host of other problems also get improved, whether it's refugees or terrorism or whatever. How do you fix that? Let's actually make an institution that focuses on how to stop war, how to protect civilians in the jargon. That encompasses many things, including limiting the power of the Permanent Five, expanding the membership of the Security Council. The UN's in a pretty bad way at the moment, and it's a bit depressing. Ban has not been a great Secretary General, to be fair. But also the governments that comprise the United Nations, I think, have been remarkably unattentive to what is going on there and unimaginative about how to fix it. Diplomats will proclaim that they want a strong UN, but they're not really affecting that. I would love Cristina Figueres to become the next Secretary General. There is a very strong tide at the UN today that it should be a woman. But unfortunately, despite the efforts of a lot of us to break open the process of appointment of the next Secretary General, which I and others have worked very hard behind the scenes to persuade countries to be more sensible about it, at the end of the day, it will still have to be somebody who the P5 approve of. In other words, somebody who Vladimir Putin is happy to have as Secretary General. And that means kind of tough, creative, independent women may not get the job. And instead, we may get some lowest common denominator type candidate who may nevertheless be female. But I'm at the moment, it kind of goes up and down. Rumours change. At the moment, one particular individual I won't name is rumoured as being the favourite of three of the P5. If she gets a job, I won't be terribly happy. There are some good candidates running, and I hope they will win.
So you've put forth some, I think, some pragmatic ways that the UN could be updated. Do you think there will be a day when we could envision a high-ambition coalition within the UN on questions like resolving conflict in Syria?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's a model that's applicable more broadly in the UN?
It's a really good question. And I think, unfortunately, the high-ambition coalition came about very much because of the phenomenon of climate change, and partly because there weren't these ossified forms of behavior like those you see in the UN Security Council. The veto of the permanent five members is a big problem. Russia can veto any form of international law on what to do about Syria. So even if you have a high ambition coalition of 30 countries that want to put sanctions on Assad, demand that he step down, recognize a democratic opposition, if you had that coalition, it would be 120 countries. There are 120 countries that have, you know, nominally recognized the democratic opposition who we advise. That's not enough to overcome a veto. The design of the system militates against it being effective. And unfortunately, I think an awful lot of countries are very worshipful of a system that was designed in 1945 for a world that is very different in 2016. And I would love, in so many contexts, but I would love to see some world leaders really think about this. We are not blessed with creative, thoughtful world leaders. There's one or two who are great, but they are very much the minority.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of Conversations at the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Karn Ross. He's a former British diplomat and executive director of Independent Diplomat. That's a network of negotiators and international lawyers. He's in conversation with Amy Barnes, partner of Allotrope Partners. And now back to our conversation.
I'm going to turn to some questions from the audience now. The first question is specifically about Independent Diplomat, and I think you touched on this a little bit, but maybe you could go into a little bit more detail, discussing how Independent Diplomat helped shape the High Ambition Coalition and how it's helping the Marshall Islands in diplomacy with other countries.
There's a difference between what I say publicly about this and what I say privately about it, because they're our client, and what goes on between them and us is between them and us. They are a fantastic client because they are all heart. They are really good. They take the job incredibly seriously. And so we were able to work with them to innovate these kind of ideas. I'm very proud to say that I have colleagues, one of whom's here, who come up with amazing ideas in diplomacy. One of them was this idea of the ratchet, the five-year ratchet, which I mentioned. That came about when three of my colleagues sat around a table in Majuro, wondering what they could do to improve the future treaty. The Majuro Declaration was born at our table, our board table. It's not really a board table, it's an IKEA table, in our office in New York. And we were just sitting around brainstorming, thinking, this is not going well. This was about 3 years ago. What the hell can the Marshalls do to stimulate better international action about climate change? And we just started with that basic question and brainstormed it from there. And one of the great things about being a little NGO and not a big government is that, you know, we had the space to do that. And I never could do that when I was a British diplomat. But then, you know, you've got to have a client who's as determined as the Marshalls are, who, you know, is willing to take risks, willing to put their neck out there. Tony de Broome did some remarkable things. The president of the Marshalls made some very brave, tough statements. He delivered a video message to the world when Ban Ki-moon had his climate summit, which you know, no doubt remember. It was a very powerful thing. So it was a combination of those things that produced this really incredible relationship and synergy and result.
So this next question is about a grassroots approach to diplomacy. And I think, you know, this actually probably dovetails nicely with some of the writing that you've done. So the question is, have you adopted or considered adopting a grassroots approach to diplomacy? If you can convince the masses to move on an issue, would that make your diplomacy easier?
I mean, the answer is definitely yes. I think one of the lessons for us from climate, but also from Syria, is that coalitions are crucial. And those coalitions are not just states. They're also civil society groups. They're individuals. The climate march that happened in New York at the same time and happened all over the world at the same time as that climate summit made a difference. Ministers were talking about it. They were empowered by it to be ambitious. But I would go a lot further than just demonstrations. I believe very strongly that actually groups of people acting in concert and in collaboration with each other without top-down organization can be immensely powerful to change things on all sorts of issues. And our belief that governments are our saviors and they are the ones who should be entrusted with the solutions on climate change or terrorism is a deeply misfounded belief. That actually we can only fix problems through a much broader based, eclectic coalition, if you like. A movement is another word for it. And, you know, that will feed from people's imaginations, from their passions, and is actually a much more empowering form of politics than just looking to a few people in a conference room to fix things.
This is another question where I think we've sort of touched on the surface of it, but maybe we can dive down a little bit deeper. So it says, you know, the words in the Paris Agreement are fine in and of themselves, but what is to ensure that the agreement will be implemented? And specifically with respect to China and India, you know, how do we encourage countries to actually do things which may actually not be, or they may not perceive to be in their own best interests?
Well, of course, the weakness of Paris is there is no policing mechanism. If India fails to keep to its commitments, it's not going to be, you know, there aren't going to be sanctions on India. It's not going to be fined. Canada walked out of the previous agreement under its Conservative government, no consequences whatsoever. So, you know, what's holding it together is, in a sense, almost like an international shaming mechanism. You've signed up to this thing, you need to perform. And I think that sense of countries looking to one another to keep to their commitments is the only real mechanism that has force in enforcing the Paris commitments. Of course, assessment, measurement really matter. And one of the things we're hoping to do with the High Ambition Coalition is get really strong monitoring of countries' fulfillment of their pledges. Because I think it does matter if, say, Saudi Arabia or Venezuela or the United States is called out and publicly, internationally shamed in international forums for not keeping to their commitments. But that is the only hard mechanism that's actually in there.
Mm. This is potentially a related question, I suppose. So this goes back to our conversation on the should versus shall, essentially the process for approving the agreement here in the U.S. without the Senate ratifying it. So can you talk a little bit about why the Senate doesn't have to ratify the agreement, maybe in a bit more detail?
Yeah, it's tricky because the State Department lawyers spent a great deal of time on this. There are legally binding elements of the Paris Treaty, including this ratchet, the five-year commitments, the requirement to come back with better carbon commitments after 5 years, that is legally binding. But the treaty as a whole is not legally binding, so it doesn't have to go to the Senate. And those words were very carefully crafted by State Department lawyers and negotiated with the rest of the world. To be honest, in a very sincere and candid way, a way that no doubt, you know, Republican senators and certain Republican presidential candidates would decry. But actually, in terms of national diplomacy, you know, the US was unimpeachably straightforward in this negotiation. And I think the Obama administration should take a great deal of credit for the success of Paris. They put an enormous diplomatic effort into this agreement with the Chinese, but also the diplomacy around the whole agreement. But the US politics has produced a position where the treaty is not legally binding. It would be better if it were, even though legally binding in a global treaty of that kind doesn't necessarily mean that much. I think words matter. Saying it's law rather than a national commitment matters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think it's interesting, sort of relevant to the previous question in terms of, you know, China and India maybe not thinking that it's in their own best interest. And I think there's certainly parts of the U.S. that would believe that it isn't in their best interests as well.
I mean, one of the funny things about these negotiations, particularly these days, is the Indians and the Chinese know about Congress. Mm-hmm. You know, they know who we're talking about. Mm-hmm. They know that we're dealing with this kind of group of vehement climate deniers. The U.S. was very transparent about that, and it's all over the newspapers. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to persuade them. They know that a legally binding treaty is going to be problematic, and the U.S. was very straight about this all the way through.
And do you and or others, the Marshall Islands, for example, worry about, you know, the upcoming elections? I mean, given that others in the world are watching Congress and watching the presidential elections, do you think there's concern about the U.S. in particular, but other countries as well, with changing political tides, sort of backpedaling on the commitments that they made to Paris?
Well, the U.S. Has been and remains the most important country in the climate change agreements. They were, in one way, one of the reasons Copenhagen didn't work out, because they refused to commit to the sort of compensation for climate change that other countries wanted. So everybody's extremely worried. I think that's the honest answer. Extremely worried. If Trump wins, then Paris will be one of the first victims. And we can hoot all we want that the US has ratified it and signed up to it. But if he wants to tear it up, he will. And there's damn all anybody else can do about it, basically. So it's a mortifying and terrifying prospect. You know, climate change, I think, is one of the most serious things at stake in this election. Not really talked about, but it is would have devastating effects for the rest of the world if the U.S. were to resile from its Paris commitments.
I'm going to turn now to a question that's both an audience question card and an extra question that I had here. They're very similar, which I think is related about the recent Brexit vote in the U.K. And I'll just take the opportunity, as a foreign British diplomat, that we have you here to stray a little bit from the topic. And just get your thoughts on Brexit, the future of the UK as we know it.
Yeah, it seems astonishing that we're asking that question. Both the Scottish referendum and now this, I think, have profoundly altered our assumptions about what kind of country we live in. And Britain now, it's a kind of platitude in the commentary, but I think it's absolutely right, now faces a prolonged period of uncertainty, because this will not get sorted out quickly, whether we leave or we stay. Mm. And I do think, actually, it's still moot whether we leave or we stay. I have a secret feeling, well, not so secret now, but that we actually won't leave, because the costs of leaving and the difficulties of leaving are so enormous that nobody has really understood how difficult it is, not just bad, but also difficult, you know, to renegotiate hundreds, if not thousands, of agreements that actually constitute what it means to be a member of the EU, including agreements with the US, because Britain is covered by all sorts of US-EU agreements about trade, but not only trade. Mm-hmm. But I think the more fundamental question you alluded to is about the future of Britain as a country, which I think is probably the most concerning aspect of all of this. Nobody really talks about it, but Northern Ireland has now been reopened. The Good Friday Agreement, which has kept peace in Northern Ireland, is essentially under question now, because Sinn Féin, the nationalists in Northern Ireland, have said that they want a vote about reuniting Northern Ireland with the rest of Ireland. Mm-hmm. I don't think that will happen. I think people are very wary of that danger, because it is a danger. Mm-hmm. But it goes to show the enormous ramifications of what this vote, you know, launched, in my view, very irresponsibly by a few conservative politicians, and campaigned for very irresponsibly by self-interested politicians, what the ramifications of this could be. And Scotland is another place where, you know, the Scottish leadership have said very, very clearly they won't go. They won't leave the EU. They won't let the rest of Britain drag them with it. Mm. So nobody knows how that will get fixed, but it's not going to happen easily.
Mm. I know you did some work with the Occupy movement, and I have read a couple pieces sort of in the aftermath of the Brexit vote, talking about how, to a certain extent, the vote sort of gave voice to some legitimate concerns amongst the British populace about sort of prosperity and the state of the economy, economic opportunity, but at the same time sort of opening the door for this anti-immigrant, anti-racist rhetoric, racist rhetoric. how you see that it's possible to address some of the former questions in a really measured and thoughtful way, some of those questions about, you know, economic opportunity and listening to some of the legitimate concerns from those who voted leave without sort of giving audience to some of the darker sides of those questions.
Sure. I think this is one of the most important political questions of our day because you confront it here, but it's also confronting countries across the world, Australia, Europe, even China to a degree. How do you address the concerns of the disenfranchised, people who feel they've been left out by economic progress? And that group has now grown enormously. You know, apart from a very small group of people, more or less everybody is not doing so well, and their relative wealth and relative incomes are in decline. So this isn't a minority of people. This is a lot of people that we're talking about. And personally, I feel that there are much better ways to address that through reforming our economy from the bottom up. Brexit is certainly not the answer to it, despite the vapid promises of those who promoted it. But Brexit certainly happened. That is one of the reasons Brexit happened. There are many reasons Brexit happened. It's also part of British stuff, rural, urban divides, the Conservative Party, immigration, the failure of the left. There's a whole ton of things going on. And one of the joys of all of this is to see your country caricatured in the way that I have caricatured so many countries in my life, to see it's about one thing. You know, I used to talk about Iraq, there's the Shia and the Sunni and the blah, and the, you know, to see your own country talked about like this is a new thing. but also, funnily enough, I mean, I work in the world of peace and security, lots of NGOs around mediation, and to see all these people like Kofi Annan make statements about my country saying, well, you know, he's very concerned about the future of the EU after the Brexit and he's very dismayed by the vote. I'm like, who the hell are you to tell me about my country? And that's what I feel. You know, I know him personally. Sure. And like, you know, imagine what anybody else feels. And it really has opened my eyes, and the work of Independent Diplomat opens my eyes to what it's like to be on the other side of the table of, you know, from the powerful, for not to be the finger wagger, but to have the, be the one whose finger is being wagged at. And bloody hell, it is an interesting experience, because the thing you feel, whatever you're being wagged your finger at, if I got it straight, you'll feel bloody angry with the person who's wagging their finger. Doesn't matter what they're arguing. So, Kofi Annan, please take note.
Well, we're trying not to be too smug as well before November ourselves.
Well, I think Americans have, you know, see awful premonitions for themselves, and they've not been quiet about that.
I wanted to turn back to talking about Independent Diplomat, because I think it's really a fascinating organization. One of the questions here is asking about how Independent Diplomat is reshaping state-to-state diplomacy. I think actually one of the interesting things in your writing is talking about the fact that increasingly state-to-state diplomacy and multilateral diplomacy still exists, but we're also looking at diplomatic and conflict issues sort of within states or between groups that are not a traditional state as we think about it.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about what Independent Diplomat is both doing in state-to-state diplomacy, but also maybe a little bit of your thinking around sort of the evolving nature of what a state is and what its importance is in the broader scheme of diplomacy?
Well, I don't think we're making a huge difference because we're really small. And things like what happened in Paris were so much beyond what I ever expected we would ever do. But in a sense, they're also very unusual, that are partly about a unique circumstance of diplomacy in a unique country like the Marshalls, a unique group of people who worked on it for Independent Diplomat, who didn't include me, I hasten to add. So we're not changing diplomacy systemically. I wish we were. Diplomacy needs to change systemically in the ways, some of the ways I've discussed. The way I feel most strongly about is what Independent Diplomat stands for, that decision-making bodies need to flipping well listen to the people they're making decisions about. One of the reasons I set it up was in my time on the UN Security Council, where I worked mostly on Iraq and WMD, we'd be talking about Kosovo, Palestine, Iraq. The one group of people you could guarantee would not be there were Kosovars, Palestinians, Iraqis. I mean, that's just kind of stupid, as well as being really unfair. And independent diplomat is trying in its small way to address that. But that seems to me a kind of systemic problem that is not that difficult to solve. We have Skype now. You can actually connect to the Gaza Strip. You know, you can follow what people in Gaza are saying as they are being attacked. You know, this communication is now more easy than it's ever been. So it is absurd that countries are kind of closing themselves off from a very available dialogue. You know, one of the things that ID has taught me and the marshals in Paris has taught me that, you know, it doesn't take a lot. Small groups of people, that famous quote, isn't it? Small groups of people can achieve a great deal when they're determined. And that is the inspiration that I've had from ID. You know, you can change. And I think the mood is of change these days, even in diplomacy, even staid old diplomats, you know, with their nice suits and their Your Excellency and all of this kind of nonsense. There is a mood of change in diplomacy. They realize that they're not really on top of a lot of things and that we need to change the way we do business.
So this next question, I think, leads naturally from that, with a focus specifically on British diplomacy, just sort of asking about whether and how British diplomacy is limited by more old-fashioned methods and a lack of diversity. What would you see changed?
Well, diversity has really changed in my lifetime in the British Foreign Office. When I joined, it was totally white, mostly private school, you know, toffee accents. And that's changed. Its gender balance has really improved. It's become much more racially diverse. We have our first gay ambassador, stuff like that, all to the good. But still very hidebound by what binds the hide, what constrains all national diplomats, which is this belief that they're representing this thing called the nation state, and that this thing called the nation state has particular needs and interests which are not the same as what ordinary humans would necessarily think about. And the process of producing those interests is in many ways certainly untransparent, but in many ways it's totally arbitrary and, in my view, foolish. National interests are abstract creations of the minds of diplomats, and they don't necessarily reflect what the people want from that country or the needs of the place. And yet they are created in these vacuums inside State Departments, Foreign Office, and then enforced upon the rest of the world with this vigor and professional body behind it in a way that I find illegitimate and frightening. And that's what I learned. I saw a government, my own government, my own colleagues, lie about a war, ignore alternatives, and wage an illegal war. And when you've seen a government like the British government, and I thought we were the good guys, when you've seen a government do that, you can never feel the same way about government or diplomacy ever again. And I saw it, and my friends did it, people I respected did it. I see you got one of them up on the wall. I didn't respect him, but he did it. And, you know, he was a democratically elected prime minister. We thought we had values. We would proclaim that we stood for the international rule of law in the UN Security Council. And we broke it. And when you've seen that, my God, you think there's got to be a better way.
We have a couple questions in here about your most recent book, The Leaderless Revolution, and the concept of gentle anarchism that you put forth in that. So I was wondering if maybe you could just talk a little bit about that. And there's a question here about, to the extent that gentle anarchy leads to the destruction or dissolution of existing structures, how can you sort of feel confident that the things that will be built in their place will be any better?
Well, I mean, this, of course, is radical territory for most people, but it is striking that somebody as conventional as me has come to believe these things, has come to call themselves an anarchist, somebody who was brought up in government, steeped in class culture, that I now believe that governments do not have things in their grip, I'm afraid to say, even though I think Paris is a great agreement. I think the evidence is all too clear that we're facing growing disorder, not order, and the basic claim of government is to provide order. And that led me, after my Iraq experience, to examine and to spend a lot of time thinking about what would provide order. And to me, it has become increasingly clear that order is best provided not through authority telling people how to behave, not through structures where people are forced to behave in particular ways, as I was forced to behave as a diplomat in a way that, frankly, I ultimately found rather inhuman. I lost sight of my humanity. I did terrible things as a diplomat. The order is best not provided through those kind of systems, but from the bottom up, through negotiation with each other directly, face to face. Not on Facebook, but with each other. And that means self-government and arbitrating our affairs directly with one another in a way that is peaceful, that is cosmopolitan, that's tolerant. All of these principles, of course, need to apply as well. And there is a word for that philosophy, and it's called anarchism. And there is an extraordinarily interesting body of thought that describes this way of behaving. It's a new form of social existence. It's not just a political philosophy. It's almost like a spiritual philosophy of how we should live. We need to trust each other, that society will have more order and stability through these mutual bonds, mutual aid. How it would look, what institutions it would have, I can't say, because we would have to create it. And it would be wrong for me to give you a blueprint of how that might look. I could suggest something. Fascinatingly, I visited last summer a society that is beginning to put these principles into practice, and that is in Syria, of all places, in northeast Syria, in Kurdish-controlled Rojava, as it's called, where anarchist ideas, extraordinarily by the most freakish chance, in fact, the anarchist ideas of a Jewish philosopher from the Lower East Side in New York City have been put into practice in northeast Syria. And what it looks like is communal self-government. It is inclusive. It's Kurds, it's Arabs, it's Assyrians. It is very much about gender equality. Women co-chair every meeting. And it's about governing from the bottom up, that the main unit of government is the village, the commune. Mm. And where they can't decide things together, it goes to a district level. And it's a remarkable thing to see. And it, even in the most difficult of circumstances, it can work. And I think that example has many lessons for us.
Great. Well, I think we have time for one more question. So taking a step back, and I know you have small children, I have small children as well, and thinking about 2030, 2050, some of the aspirational years that the climate negotiations are set against, what's your greatest hope and greatest fear, both for the climate change talks and maybe for the world of diplomacy more broadly, sort of out to that time frame?
I think my greatest fear is complacency. I think that, you know, the risk of climate change is very severe and unprecedented. And these are kind of obvious platitudes, but what that means is we have no idea how bad it could be. And that scares the hell out of me, for them as much as anything, because I think the world that we took for granted won't be available for them. I think we may see massive displacements of populations, and with that, enormous economic stresses, but also security stresses. Because when you have massive displacements, where do people go? And we're not proving ourselves the most generous of hosts these days. So that is going to be a huge stress on the world system. And I don't think the world system is particularly well designed to deal with these enormous challenges. So I'm pretty scared, to be honest. And I think this is partly why I kind of ripped up my political philosophy and tried to start from first principles and try to think really hard about what might work, but also what kind of society I would want to live in that isn't about states competing over their national interests, which I think is just a nonsensical way to think about the world and each other as human beings, or us competing with each other as humans in the economy, when actually we enjoy trusting one another and helping each other far more than we do competing with one another. And why can't we build a society that celebrates and promotes those things rather than the opposite?
On behalf of the World Affairs Council, please join me in thanking Karn Ross for this excellent, really excellent discussion.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of conversations at the World Affairs Council. This program featured Karn Ross, Executive Director of Independent Diplomat. He was in conversation with Amy Barnes, partner of Allotrope Partners. Visit us at worldaffairs.org to take part in upcoming conversations or to become a member of the World Affairs Council. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.